Welcome to Red Inca. I'm Jared Kimber. This Red Inca is about Ireland's World Cup team. And for that, we get on one of the best Irish writers.
Nathan Johns, cricket writer at the Irish Times.
We speak about going from a rugby professional to a cricketer. Lorcan Tucker's funk, Harry Tector, the long batting order, bowling and facing spin, their biggest issues at the death, how the contract situation might cause issues, and their best slash worst case scenarios. Start with this for me, mate. Ross Adair's story, because I think this is good fun, and I don't know how many cricket fans actually know about this.
Yeah, it's great fun. It's been quite well told at back here at home, because he was a rugby player. So obviously, when he first got a call up just over a year ago, maybe 2 years ago now, a lot of the national press kind of, oh, rugby, let's talk about cricket through a different sport lens because we're interested in the other sport more. He played once for Ulster, which is one of the four provincial professional sides in Ireland, and then moved and he played in the English Championship for Jersey for a while. And that kind of didn't end very well for him. He had a lot of injuries, and I think there was contract issues, etc. But he essentially had to retire because of injuries. I think hips were a big problem. But obviously, being the older brother of Mark Adair, cricket ran in the family, and he was always a pretty decent club cricketer. Whacked it for his club, opened the batting and hit it everywhere. And that was at a time where Ireland were really struggling for power hitters in T20. So he got a look in very quickly with the domestic interpro scene. He played for the Northern Knights, the Belfast-based team. And eventually he got a call-up. Now, his record is mixed at international level, and there's a lot of people who probably think he's left it too late to become an international cricketer. And also him playing interpros is not going to prepare him to try and hit Shaheen Afridi over his head. As he had to try and do last week. He did actually, in fairness to him, he did hit Mohammed Amir over his head when he tried to pitch one up and swing it. But apart from that, he struggled. But look, it's a great story. He's, late 20s, I think, and he's changed and he's played two sports professionally, one at international level, and he's playing with his younger brother, who's one of Ireland's most important players, and Mark. So yeah, it's a lovely feel-good story.
I can't think of that many cricketers who play professional rugby either. I know there must be some in New Zealand, just because I just assume there is. Liam Botham is one that I can think of, or I think played professionally in both. So, but there really aren't that many. So it's, like, when I first looked it up, I had to make sure it was rugby and it wasn't some Gaelic sport, and I was getting confused because I was like, really? That just doesn't seem like a natural crossover. But I suppose cricket has changed to become more of a power hitting kind of thing, and big dudes are getting paid now.
Well, what I would say is demographically, definitely in Ireland, I assume it's the same in the UK, it's definitely a crossover.
Well, you mean posh guys.
Yeah, that's exactly that. Being slightly more diplomatic. Yeah, but like cricket has lost lots of players to rugby, probably because rugby's obviously the more lucrative professional endeavour. Like there's two guys who are in my club who are younger than me who played for Ireland at under 20 level at rugby. They don't play cricket anymore. They're trying to make it as rugby players. Rugby fans will probably recognise the name Josh van der Fleer, World Player of the Year a couple of years ago. Irish guy, despite the surname, he was born in Ireland. Him and his brother were both really, really good cricketers. But Josh obviously made it as a professional rugby. So in Ireland, there's loads of cricketers that have been lost to rugby, but less so guys coming back, because obviously one professional sport is far more lucrative than the other.
Yeah, no, exactly. I haven't been following Irish fans too much during this series. During the squad announcement. Obviously, I've seen them play a couple of times, Pakistan and the Netherlands game. But I'm just assuming, just because it's cricket, is there anything that the fans are angry about from this squad?
In terms of the squad, no, because I don't think there's nobody in the first choice 11 who you could make a plausible argument for they shouldn't be there, really. Therefore, it needs to reach that threshold, I think, to get proper anger. There's always a few people on Twitter who are going particularly mad at different things. Poor old Graham Hume, the medium fast bowler, he had a tough time against Pakistan where he dropped two catches in the second T20. And I'm always reluctant to say catches cost a match, because who knows what happens after that in a T20. But he dropped both set batters, and both of them batted Ireland out of the game within the next three overs. So make of that what you will. And then he dropped another one in the next game that wasn't as important, but he just looked like a man who's mentally shot, and he went at nearly over 10 and over in his bowling as well. So a lot of people were kind of, viciously typing at keyboard saying this guy needs to get out of the squad. What hasn't helped his cause is that the series in the Netherlands right now, he couldn't get a visa on time for it, because he's a South African citizen. So he actually, he wasn't dropped, but he's not in that series. And the bloke who just replaced him, Fionn Hand, got 3-0 in the first game against the Dutch. So now everyone's going, Hume's dropping catches and getting whacked, bring in Hand. And the reality is it doesn't matter because none of these guys are going to play whenever Josh Little comes back into the side anyway. We're talking about a backup seam bowling slot unless they drop someone like Craig Young, which would be a big call. But yeah, so that's probably the only big selection call in terms of personnel. It's a very settled 15 or 16 man group at the minute.
Lorcan Tucker, I think you and I have talked about him a lot before. He certainly was one of the standouts in the last T20 World Cup. You know, played that incredible innings against Australia. He's been ascending. I would say that if I'm just having a look at his numbers now, probably this is the best year he's had in T20 cricket outside of maybe 2021. Averages just under 30 with a strike rate of 146. Like, he hasn't played a lot of games this year so far, but he's the big difference maker in that top order, isn't he?
Well, let's go back because, so his last couple of games, I think 50, 70, 40, both two of those against Pakistan and their attack. So obviously a lot of people taking notice of that. But before that, his only score of note since the last World Cup was 90-odd against Austria in the T20 World Cup qualifiers in Scotland last year. I think since that Pakistan series, between the last World Cup and now, I think he had, if I'm right in saying, he had averaged 5 against full member nations. So he had his...
That's hard to do.
He had his unbelievable year where he only started batting 3 initially because of COVID, because loads of guys got COVID in the US. Started batting 3, got 80 and 90 in that game, had an unbelievable year, hit runs against South Africa, hit that innings against Australia you mentioned, and then basically since then had completely the opposite. It's staggering how a guy can go from being, looks like the most natural number 3, why didn't we promote this guy before, to he can't hit the ball off the square. And he said it before, you know, he's been very open about his struggles, but then all of a sudden he's come back and now he's scoring runs for fun again. So in terms of the tap has turned on at the right moment for him, and absolutely, yeah, he is a difference maker. There's a line of thought that, but given where he bats and the way he bats, he can produce those types of innings with those strike rates anywhere in the order almost. Mm-hmm. Whereas someone like Harry Tector at 4 is almost wasted because he could do with the extra 5 balls you get from batting at 3 and he could pace it. So there is quite an interesting discussion about getting someone like Tector up at 3. But right now, Tucker's scoring runs and they're a couple of weeks out from World Cup. So that's not going to change in the short term. And while Tucker is scoring runs, those conversations are certainly going to diminish. But while he was averaging 5 against full members for the bones of a year, there was a lot of conversations saying, okay, we're not going to drop him, but we probably should drop him down the order a little bit. But like I said, he's scoring lots of runs now.
Well, I mean, Tector was my next question because his strike rate is an issue. And it makes more sense for me to have Tucker at 3 and Tector at 4 because you've got the hitters coming after that. But I wondered if there's been, I know there is constant conversation about his strike rate in general. Just having a look, 2024, 16 games, he's got a strike rate of 126. Last year, he had a strike rate of 110 in 16 games.
Yeah, and it's something that he's very, very, working very hard at. It was interesting when he went to the Bangladesh Premier League in January, they actually got him to open the batting. Which I was a big fan of because, you know, he hits pace pretty well and get him in the power play and see if you can add 5 points to that strike rate, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And I think he batted 3 or 4 times. He struggled in the first 2 and then he hit a 70 or something like that in the third outing. So now Ireland aren't going to do that because their opening pairing of Sterling and Balburnie is really well settled. But it's a really, really interesting conversation. And when you look at Tector in ODI and you go, he just knows how to pace in ODI innings almost perfectly at this stage. He's had that rise up to rankings don't mean anything, but in this case, they kind of do. He's gone into the top 5 of the world in ODI batting rankings. He just knows how to, and if he can bring that ability to pace in innings and just obviously condense it a lot in T20, he started to show signs of doing that. There was an innings against Afghanistan where he almost had to come down a gear because of so many wickets falling around him. And he's just, his ability to explode at the end is unparalleled. The problem is he needs that 10-15 balls to get to that stage, I think, if not more. I think his battle is bringing down that number of balls, and he has done it. Like, you know, his strike rate this year is more than it was last year. Like, he's slowly doing it. He's almost, because he's such a gritty competitor, this isn't based on anything scientifically, this is just kind of based on his character and knowing him as I do. I think he's almost so just loves the fight. He almost works better in those situations where he's kind of rebuilding from a collapse and then he kind of explodes at the end, because otherwise then you have that. He does have to go at 130, 140 from ball one. The Pakistan series was really interesting because the first game he did that. He only got about 30, but that was one of the best I've seen him in terms of fluency batting in T20. He just looked on it from ball one. Second innings, comes in, he pulls, I think it was Shaheen, or maybe it was Abbas, one of those two. He pulls them on the front foot for six, first ball. And you're going, right, we're actually seeing some consistent, he's figured out how to pace these innings. But then from thereafter, and then in the third innings, the third T20, he just kept hitting fielders. And you could just see him getting frustrated. The bat turns in his hand, he gets caught at long on for, you know, 130 strike rate or whatever, which he probably needed more given the size of the ground. So it's really, really interesting. I think he is improving, and every now and then, like that first Pakistan innings, you see a knock where you're going, he's got it figured out. He's managed to figure out how to pace in innings. Because if he does, I don't think there's anybody, nobody disputes that he is their best player once he figures out how to pace a T20 innings, which, look, it's going to be really interesting to see if he does that in the upcoming World Cup. Because, yeah, if he gets that right, he'll be the next guy, I think, that kind of goes down the Josh Little route and starts getting picked up by various different organizations. Because in terms of pure ball striking, there's no one better in the Irish side, at least.
Cricket 8 brings you this show. They are a new player in the game trying to educate fans on what is really happening in cricket. Head over for their watch-alongs, podcasts and articles on what is happening on the field and why it matters. Cricket 8 is your place for cricket intelligence. What is better, the top four or all those middle-order whackers? What's their strength in their batting?
Oh, middle-order whackers. Yeah. There's a conscious...
I'm glad you said that. I would have been very disappointed if you didn't.
Oh, and well, first of all, I mean, Balbirnie's actually batting really well in the last year in T20 cricket. He probably deserves that. Sterling hasn't scored a significant T20 innings in a long, consistently. There's been a few, but like since 2022, he's been struggling in T20. I don't know why that is. It's the reason he doesn't play any franchise competitions anymore, really. So, and obviously Tucker had that year when he was averaging five against full members. So, They've made a conscious decision, and I disagree with this a little bit, but they've made a conscious decision as a side that their game plan is some over 6 to 10, 11, 12. They don't get out of third gear. They say, right, we're just going to extend the game here so Camford, Dockrell, Adair, McCarthy, those guys can come in and whack pace at the end. Dockrell spin a little bit as well. They bat down to 9. McCarthy, when they get the order right, Gareth Delaney as well, they bat down to number 9 with guys who can comfortably clear the ropes with consistency. My attitude is, we've just seen England do that and they got Rashid coming in at 9 and they just say, right, we're just going to go hard from ball one. Ireland say, no, we have to extend the game as long as possible to give these guys the opportunity to win the game for us at the end. My attitude is, okay, that's fine, but given death hitting is so volatile, if that doesn't work and you've been going at 7 and over for the bones of your innings, you're going to really struggle. And that's what caught them out in the, I can't remember which, I think it was the last T20 against Pakistan, where they just didn't get anywhere near enough runs. Yeah, they only got like 170, whereas the previous game they got 190 and they just didn't bowl very well. And yeah, so it's kind of like we've got one way to win here, which is our hitters are going to hit us to either chase us down a total, they need to chase, I think, more often than not, or they're going to hit us to a total that our somewhat weak death bowling can just about hang on to and defend, which for me is a little bit, right, well, why don't you just back... The other way they phrase it is, I remember asking the coach, Heinrich Mahl, about this, and he said, oh, we just want our better batters to face as many balls as possible. And he's obviously talking about his top four there. And that's fine, but again, I'm saying, look, there are other teams in the world who've had a lot of success with really long lineups saying, right, we'll lose one or two games really, in really ugly fashion, but, you know, we also will be able to hit 200 consistently, which I think this Irish team could do if they had a slight positive mindset shift.
Yeah, it's interesting because you're right. They do bat, you know, so deep. And I remember watching some of the Pakistan games specifically and just thinking to myself, do they not know they bat deep? Or but I suppose that makes sense. But this could be two very different World Cups as well. In the first World Cup in America, they might actually want to attack a lot more early on, whereas the idea of taking the game deeper in the second part in the West Indies might make a little bit more sense. So you need to be versatile, and World Cups are about problem solving. And if you go in with one theory, generally teams will work that out quite quickly and just, you know, play off you. Can they bat against spin is my question. Because we're going to the West Indies. There's going to be, you know, if they get to that part of the tournament, it's going to turn, right?
Well, it's a big if, right?
It is a big if. But I'll let that question for the end. But I'm saying if they do get to that part of the tournament, The spinning ball is full on, right?
Yeah, they absolutely prefer pace on the ball. Again, one of the reasons why I'm not a big fan of this middle overs, third gear type thing is because if you look at the guys who are going to be doing that, more often than not, it's Tucker and Tector, and they both have like really low strike rates against left arm spin, for example. They just don't score. Even though Tucker loves to sweep everything, he gets out a lot doing it. So the answer, I mean, look, I'm not going to turn around here and say they can't play spin. Dockrell has turned the way he hits the ball straight. He can be quite an effective hitter against spin, but that's obviously very different from if he does have to come in early and bat their way through a tricky chase or setting up a total on a turning Caribbean track. So it's definitely the way you would go about attacking them, which is probably why the Pakistan series and playing Pakistan for a potential place in the knockouts isn't the worst matchup for them, because as much as the Pakistan spinners haven't been bowling very well, Imad's been bowling well, but that's it. Like Shadab got hit out of the attack in the first T20, wasn't seen again. And it was only when the seamers finally turned up in the last game that Ireland kind of looked like a really struggling side. So look, it's going to be really interesting. I have no idea what the pitch. I don't think anyone knows what the pitches are going to be like in New York, and in New York at least. So no. I know they've got the drop-in pitches, but no one has a clue what's coming there. But yeah, Ireland prefer pace on the ball, and Sterling is a really good player of spin, but the problem is he just can't buy a run at the minute. So look, it's the old adage of Ireland can win games without Sterling now, but if they get into a stage of the competition where they're being thrown, death by spin, he's going to be all of a sudden a really important player for them in a series where he's not playing very well. It's the reason why, of all the big sides that Ireland have beaten, every time they get thrown against Sri Lanka, they just struggle. Because Sri Lanka just have loads of them. Really... Yeah, the last World Cup in Hobart, they had their massive high of Scotland and West Indies, and everyone forgets that 2 days later, Sri Lanka just... it was not competitive at all. Because Sri Lanka have all these just really clever finger spinners that can just tie you up and hold down ends, and they have three or four of them, and Ireland...
That's why you look at this, and obviously India should beat them, right? Like, that shouldn't be a contest. I haven't seen much of Canada. USA's fine, but I think Ireland's clearly a better side than the USA. But the Pakistan game, there's no great spinner. Even Imad Wasim, who you mentioned before, he's a holding spinner, right? Like, he shouldn't run through them the way that Hasaranga might run through them or, someone like that. So it's not a terrible draw to be in. And then who knows what the pitch is going to be like, as you said before.
Well, exactly. Yeah. And I think the Pakistan one is really interesting because they let Imad bowl a little bit in the last series. They only really tried. And that's because of that kind of third, fourth gear, middle overs bit that they have. Whereas again, you'd go, right, well, if Pakistan have one spinner and if you get him out of the attack, you get to face either some part-time filth or you get to face guys bowling where they don't want to be bowling. And, they want to hold Shaheen back for the end. They want to hold Amir back for the end. You can really... Pakistan, we're talking about plans and one, like a friend of mine who's a Pakistani journalist was saying, for all Ireland's one-dimensional plans, Pakistan are one-dimensional. If you hit Imad out of the attack, Babar doesn't know what to do. He doesn't know where to go. And I'm sitting there going, Ireland are preaching, oh, we want to be more dynamic, more positive in T20 cricket. Well, just hit their one spinner at the attack, or at least you bat till nine. So if you get out doing so, you can still change tack and survive. But they didn't really try and do that. It wasn't the case that they tried and failed. They didn't try. But anyway, that's just a long-winded way of saying, yeah, it's actually a pretty good matchup, especially because when India have played them in the past, hitting India's seamers back over their heads have not been an issue for Ireland. It's been not conceding 190 against an Indian batting lineup when they played in the last couple of years.
What about bowling spin?
Yeah, it's really interesting. They've got two leggies, and more often than not, recently they've actually only bowled one of them. They keep changing their mind about whether George Dockrell is an option with the ball, the left arm spinner or not. A year ago they said we're going to pick five frontline bowlers and we're not going to bowl Camphor and Dockrell, and Camphor bowled loads last week and Dockrell all of a sudden is bowling again. I just think because they just don't have one really good spinner, they just need to kind of ride the hot hand, so to speak, and I think that's fine. Because they're aware of their resources, but don't come out and say, we're not going to use this guy because he's a part-timer. We don't trust him when everyone else gets whacked and you have to use him. Ben White has had a good year. He's got a pretty good average, and I think his economy is a 7 in T20 the last year or something like that, and he got a really good 4 for in helpful conditions against Afghanistan recently. But he's a leg spinner, but he's not going to run through you. I know I said he just got 4 for, but he's very much a container. It's interesting. Gareth Delaney's fascinating because he had a really good World Cup last time around. when Nathan Hart's a spin coach. He had some really good plans, bowl googlies to the West Indies and get them to hit the big square boundaries, and they all got caught in the rope. So he's got a history of like being able to hold a plan really well and stuff like that. But if those plans don't work, and the other thing is, obviously, if those plans don't work, who knows what's going to happen. But the other thing, Ireland, just for some reason, and this is definitely a coaching shift under the head coach who came in 2022, if in doubt, they just go with the pace option. And this is probably because they don't trust their spinner, but like there have been games where they've just bowled one spinner, which just seems odd. You know, you don't have that pace. You don't have, you know, with the old ball, especially, Ireland don't have the ability to break games open. Josh Little occasionally does when he's playing. So yeah, you'd almost like say, well, okay, well, don't let the perfect be the enemy of the good enough. Do you know what I mean? If you have a part-timer who can give you two overs for 14 rather than, you know, relying on pace, that's not going to do anything for you. So it's interesting. It's not quite good enough to win the matches, their spin attack. And as a result, they sometimes make some strange decisions about how they use it.
The last World Cup, there was so much conversation about these spinners and who should be going and who shouldn't be going. And like they've completely moved on to that too. Sort of Ben White and then trying to convince Dockrell he could still bowl and occasionally asking Delaney if he can bowl, right? Like it's been an issue for, well, probably almost all the way through, really. They've never had a great T20 spinner, have they? I don't mean great, but even a top quality, consistent T20 spinner hasn't really, I can't think of that many guys, you know, that, you know, McBride obviously has been good in other formats, but I'm not sure the T20 is maybe his best one anyway. There aren't that many off spinners who do well in it.
No, well, I mean, yeah, him and Simi Singh was the big conversation at the last World Cup, and they dropped McBride for Singh very late on, which was probably the right call. You know, any game that Singh played against left-handers, he got a couple of wickets, even though they did eventually drop him, and that was his international career done. He was an interesting one because he bowled a lot in the power play and at the death, and he had pretty much the same economy as McBride, even though he probably should be more expensive, which is probably a sign that, like you said, McBride's T20 just wasn't his format. But yeah, you're absolutely right. They're struggling. They've really invested a lot of time in Ben White as that white ball, flat, skiddy, leggy, turns his googly a little bit, with mixed results. He's had a good year if you look at his overall numbers, but you look at how many individual games he's won for Ireland, which is kind of what the best teams have from their spinners, and they don't have that. That I think, you know, like I said, Delaney went a long way to winning them a game against the West Indies in the last World Cup, but since then, yeah, it's been against really, really good sides. That white four-for is probably the only spell of note in the last 2 years from any of their spinners.
New ball bowling has never been a huge problem. I mean, they can go for runs sometimes, but they certainly take wickets. Adair at his absolute best can swing the ball both ways. He can also bowl some of the worst balls you've ever seen, but he certainly has a great best ball. They will have to bowl some of their seam in the middle, and obviously Josh Little will come back. But their death bowling, and I had this as my major concern coming in, and then you and I spoke off air, and so I know it's one of yours as well. It does feel, especially, I mean, we don't know how much this latest IPL will impact the way that teams go about batting in this World Cup. But we do know that teams are pretty confident now hitting 20 runs and over, right? And you look at Ireland's death bowling, little aside, there's a lot of runs that can come from that.
Well, even little.
Well, I mean, he can take wickets. You're right. He's not going to be great on economy, but you know, he can be. He can at least get dot balls through pace.
Yeah, absolutely. Ireland don't have an objectively top-end death bowler. Mark Adair has had to become one because, like you said, really good with the new ball. His record, his average with the new ball in T20 cricket is really good. I think that was the reason he got in the team of the year, wasn't it? The ICC team of the year. But his lack of pace means he doesn't really bowl much during the middle because he can't, because of his lack. So the only thing, he had to try and bowl some variations so he could be effective at the death. And he has good days and he has bad days, but he's much more likely to get it wrong if his variations go wrong just because of that lack of pace. And it can go wrong. Against Pakistan, the last second two games, death bowling wasn't really an issue because Pakistan had won the game before, like the proper death overs, do you know what I mean? Like they chased 190 in less than 17 overs, which was staggering. It's an issue. And I don't really know why, because, you know, the domestic T20 games, while the standard isn't particularly high, they still can be quite high scoring. They're still played on really small grounds. flat enough pitches, not roads, but, you know, 50-yard boundaries on one side. So these guys aren't short of trying to, you know, it being in situations where even average domestic players can still try and can still hit them. It's a concern, and it probably is that pace element. Ireland just doesn't produce that many fast bowlers. There's a couple of guys who have a bit of extra pace in the system, but one or two of them aren't qualified. So one of them doesn't get
selected. The pacing is interesting. I wonder if, and this might be because the wickets are greener and more helpful to seam bowling up there, what Ireland hasn't really produced is slow ball bowlers, right? Of like, do you know what I mean? Guys who can, and if you think about it, you could probably put Scotland in that as well. Scotland hasn't had a lot of slow ball bowlers either. And it might just be that the wickets are greener and more helpful to normal seam. And you don't need to rely on that. But there haven't really been many death bowlers that you would say are really strong slow ball guys from there.
Yeah, it's an interesting one because they've had long enough now of a proper white ball domestic setup. Yep. Granted, it was interrupted for a couple of years during COVID, but it's been going for long enough now, and they've played. And whatever the point about the domestic setup, like, these guys just play a lot of international cricket now. They play a lot more international cricket than they do. Like, they should, if someone like Harry Tector is able to learn at international level cricket and have the success he can, you know, I know bowling, the skills are different, arguably the reward, risk reward, etc. But why have they not got one guy who's developed two or three excellent slower balls? They probably would argue that Adair is that guy. But like I said, his lack of ball speed means when it goes wrong, it just can go horrifically wrong. I think I saw a stat somewhere that, like, Mark Adair has bowled the highest proportion of wides at the death than like anyone else in international cricket at the minute. Which, again, that shows his lack of pace, because he either has to really challenge those wide lines,
yeah,
or he has to go to his variations. And obviously that, just because there's no pace, and that means it can go wrong. I don't really know why, because I take your point, but at the same time, they've been doing this at domestic level for long enough now, and they've also had what, 6-7 years of a proper international schedule, or at least something close to it, that somebody should have learned on the job by now.
Yeah, I get what you mean, but I suppose what I'm saying is, like, you could say that about England and spinners, right? Like, England have been playing Test cricket for a long time, and where, you know, since Laker and Locke and Underwood, they've had Swan, right? And not really that many other top level spinners. Like, you are one way or another locked into your conditions. I'm really interested with Adair, because I have seen him bowl a lot of wides. I didn't realize he was that bad, but I remember commentating on some of the games they played. I can't remember what series it was, whatever I was commentating on. And he really attacks that wide line, unlike many other bowlers. There's nothing wrong with that. It's a good tactic. But I don't think he's accurate enough to pull it off. That's not his main skill.
No, his main skill is new ball bowling. Yeah. I think to survive, he's had to bowl. Like I said, he has to bowl at the death almost, because everyone, it's almost like he has to bowl at the death because everyone else has to bowl in the middle, if that makes sense. I don't really know why he's the anointed variations wide Yorker guy at the death, when, you know, it could be like Barry McGarthy probably is no worse. He's just done it a lot and not as often as Adair. Ireland need new ball wickets to be successful, because they don't have a spinner who's going to run through an attack, and anything under 15 and over in the line at the death, I wouldn't be confident in them defending. Just with their record. Now the Pakistan games didn't help, because the straight boundary was 48 meters, but even still, like, this is something that's been going on for a while.
Obviously there's a contract mess going on over there at the moment. We won't go too deep into it. Has it upset the players? Is there a distraction, or is it just one of these things that happens and they were promised a contract and it didn't come through the way that they wanted and both sides are moaning?
Nobody's moaning, publicly.
publicly is a key phrase there, but continue.
Yeah, I think it was the latter point what you made, and there were a few moans and groans, and some players I think most of the players were very frustrated, just because it dragged on and they had to play a couple of months still on last year's terms. The contracts ended at the end of February, but it's been resolved now. They were looking for pay rises. They probably didn't get the pay rises that they initially wanted and or were verbally might have been promised. I mean, Cricket Ireland has had some pretty big financial event, not events, that makes it sound drastic, but they've had a couple of things, like they basically got close to $2 million less than they thought they would have at this point in the season. So anything any positive conversations that might have happened before the official negotiations started, probably couldn't be, they couldn't be honoured. It's something along those lines, I think. And yeah, players are frustrated. It got out into the press, which is, you know, obviously predominantly my fault. But obviously when players are, I'm going to start that sentence again. But when people are obviously talking to journalists and stuff, it's a sign that things aren't particularly happy. I know a lot of people thought that it was portrayed as more unhappy than it actually was, but I think it's one of those where it depends on who you talk to. But ultimately, any frustration, like Andrew Balbirnie said it well. He's kind of said, look, we're united off the pitch, we're united on the pitch. And to me, after the Pakistan win and in a previous interview about test matches or about Australia series being cancelled, he says, look, we're used to problems. We just go out and try and win games of cricket. We're used to there being issues off the pitch. And I think this is just another one of those. It was very frustrating because they didn't know how much money they were going to be earning this year for a good while, which is, you know, frustrating in a short career. But it never got to, I don't think it ever got to the stage where you said off air, you gave me the example of players going on strike with different countries. I don't think it was ever going to get to that.
That was Kenya, yeah. But they made the semifinals of that World Cup. I'm just saying, if the island players threatened to go on strike, we could have them penciled down as finalists. So in many ways, the island players have let themselves down there. Okay, I'm going to ask you two final questions. What is the worst case scenario for Irish cricket in this World Cup? So we are assuming... let's assume they don't lose all four games, although that is the absolute worst, but you would probably think that they're at least going to win one of those four. Is that the worst case scenario? They beat Canada, but they lose to the other three?
If you've not given me the option of zero from four, then yeah.
You can't have zero. They're not going to lose all four games, are they? They just beat Pakistan.
No, they shouldn't. I'm not being pessimistic. I quite enjoy watching this side in T20 yeah. cricket. This is probably the best T20 outfit they've had. I don't think it's the most talented, but I think it's the best run, and the people at the top, captain and coach, get it, the short format, more than they have in previous years.
So does that mean the worst case scenario is more likely that they just lose to India and Pakistan then? Or do you think...
No. That's par for me. I think if they beat the US and Canada and they lose because they've lost in a one-off knockout game against Pakistan, no one's going to call this World Cup a failure.
Losing to the USA or Canada is worst case scenario then.
I think they should. I think they've earned the right for people to be disappointed with results like that. Yeah,
that makes sense.
They haven't won a lot in T20 cricket, but they've played a lot of good, entertaining brand. But which, you know, against a side that's supposedly weaker, if it comes off, they've earned the right to be favourites in those games.
What is their best case scenario?
Oh, qualifying for the next round. It's the same as the last World Cup. Once they got through that initial period, it's kind of all bets are off, you know, and they only went, well, they're a really good side when the pressure is off. Mm. Last year's World Cup qualifiers in Zimbabwe, pressure was on, they were awful. And then all of a sudden, once they were knocked out, they won all their games. Similarly, in the last World Cup, to be fair, they won two big pressure games, but then pressure off, they go off and they beat England, granted with a little bit of help from the rain. But yeah, they're a very good side at, if they get to a next stage and they get to go to the Caribbean, that's, you know, who knows? Not who knows what they can do, because they're a very limited side. But you know, they could easily go on one of these magical Irish World Cup runs where they beat someone and everyone talks about cricket at home for a week, 10 days, which would be, you know, be a lot of fun. It's first 2 weeks of June, summer at home. You know, that would be a lot of fun. But yeah, God, if they manage to beat, I really just can't see them beating India. So I keep saying, if they manage to get to that last game in Florida against Pakistan, and they manage to get over the line, they beat them recently. Absolutely. Like, I think everybody would be euphoric at home.
And then, so let's imagine they do that. Is the best case scenario then just qualifying, or is it winning one game as well? Because, you know, they played some good cricket in the last tournament. I know it's completely different because they're different kinds of qualifying, and this will be a much higher level. But if they do make it to the, what is it, top eight sides, isn't it, at that stage? Is the best case scenario still winning one game, or does that not matter? Just getting to the top eight sides is enough from an Irish cricket point of view.
No, I think they should win a game in that. I don't know. I have no idea who they'd be playing.
Yeah, well, I mean, we can't tell who they're going to play. Yeah. So that bit we don't know. Yeah. But I'm just assuming they make it to that level. You still give them a chance of winning a game when they're there.
Yeah, absolutely. T20 cricket, You know, who knows? Maybe one of their spinners comes good on a turning track in the Caribbean or something like that. No, they should absolutely look to keep the positivity going, because I think that kind of hurt them a little bit in the last World Cup, where they qualified, they had that big high of the Scotland West Indies games, they beat England with the rain, and then they kind of just fell off a little bit after that.
That weird Australian game too, didn't they? Where Lorcan made it look better than it probably was. Am I remembering that right?
Well, they were nothing for four. They were like 20 for four or something.
That's right.
The game is completely gone, and Tucker came out swinging and had the best innings of his life. And there was that, and then the Josh Little hat trick against New Zealand, which were great moments, but like they weren't competitive in those games. And that it didn't kill a little bit of momentum because everybody wanted them to do well. But at the same time, that actually did cost them automatic qualification for the next, for this World Cup. Now, obviously, that's not at stake here. It's much more rankings-based, and I think they should be safe for 2026. But yeah, look, if it wouldn't be Irish cricket without going on a bit of a run and beating somebody at the next stage.
Thank you very much for coming on the podcast.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you for listening. This podcast has an ad-free version via Patreon, where there are also many other extras as well, including a Discord channel where you can chat to me directly. There is a link to the Patreon in the show notes. We are an independent podcast, so support us any way you can. Maybe give us a review, subscribe, or share on social media. All of these things help us. And when it comes to podcasts, word of mouth is always the best way of making it grow. If we had a guest on, chances are their socials are in the show notes. Please support everyone who comes on this show. I am Jared Kimber, and this is my network. But we also have hosts and co-hosts like Bairam Kazi and Estelle Vassadevan. This network is overseen by Nick McCorriston, and each episode is produced by Ishit Kaburka at Sound Potion Studio. Mukunda Bandredi, or Muku as most people will know, is the head of our YouTube channels, and he also helps out with so many other things like the podcast recordings. And there's so many other people we could thank here, but I just want to thank all the listeners and all the people who help behind the scenes that make this podcast work. If you make a lot of content like me, oh, you are going to need help. And that is why we use Minvo.pro, a slicing and dicing tool that uses AI to conjure up incredible clips from your podcasts and meetings. If you make content, go to Minvo.pro to cut it.